I'm Ruby.
And I'm Cody.
And this is
The Swirl.
Hey, we
and
did
as
it.
Promised, we're finally getting to our book club episode. So welcome, everyone, to Swirl Book Club.
But you can't hurry love, Cody. You just have to wait. And
this is why none of my relationships work. I just try to jam it on through. Just try to
That's
really,
what she said. That's what
just
she
really
said.
Try to just attack people with my love. So no, I hurry love all the time, and then you find out it was just lust. And you didn't really have a good opportunity to assess your feelings.
Totally. But I did not have to take my time loving this book. I definitely immediately, from page one, I loved this book. And I texted you right away and I said, oh my god, Gabourey Sidibe is a female version of you.
Well, I don't discuss potentially getting raped as much with my mother. That's maybe one of the only differences. But I was really fascinated by, and by the way, guys, we're talking about This Is Just My Face, Try Not to Stare by Gabourey Sidibe.
Which, the title alone is goddamn amazing. She's so cool. I love her. And the cover of the book with her pose, like, she's just great. I love her.
I felt an instant familiarity with her. There's something about when you grow up as an overweight person, you are very aware of yourself and your body and how people perceive you. And some people make the decision to make themselves small and try to recede into the background, or some people own it. And you can see with her, she had to reconcile her weight a long time ago.
Right.
And you almost have to create an armor. And I definitely related to those aspects of her story growing up, where you kind of have to really form a thick skin or really become funny because you need a defense mechanism to step outside every day.
Totally.
And she makes a good mention in the book about how she was not in control of her in control of her weight, primarily because she wasn't in control of what happened in the kitchen. And this happens to a lot of people who are overweight. You know, her mother is this famous Subway busker, I believe they call them. And in fact, her mother almost was cast as Mary, the character that won Monique an Oscar in the movie Precious. Her mother worked these odd hours, and they really were in a sort of destitute living situation.
Yeah, and poverty totally, like, contributes in a lot of ways to poor eating habits for a plethora of reasons.
Right.
One is the stress of, like, there's the stress of poverty and not being able to get to fresh foods, but also afford fresh foods. But also, when you're stressed out and working really hard jobs or long hours, sometimes you just want a friggin' french fry, dude.
And that's compounded with the fact that as she was getting heavier, she stopped eating in front of people, which I think a lot of people can relate. I think anyone who reads the book and gets a grasp that Gabourey was having eating disorder issues.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty, you know, I think it turns on its head what a person who's suffering from anorexia or bulimia looks like.
Right.
And I think in a lot of ways she does that in the book. She, like, really has this great habit of turning things on its ear. Like, she was a sex worker, essentially. She which is one of the funnier elements of the book.
That might be my favorite part of the book, is when she talks about being a sex phone operator for a lot of reasons. So it's a really light book. It's not, you know, you're not struggling to get through this book. It's not dense by any sense of the word, but she kind of drops a lot of cultural knowledge about sex and how sex is viewed in that one section about being a sex phone operator. Like, the fact that most of the women who worked the phones were plus size black women, and that they had to pretend to be like young white girls because the people calling were white men looking for relief.
She talked about essentially that there was a hierarchy to what a woman of a certain ethnicity or race could command, which is anyone in life would know that. Anyone who is quote-unquote woke would understand that
And seeing how that would work laid bare in, like, sex phone operator, like, hierarchy was kind of interesting. And then the other thing she kind of just drops in there is that a lot of times they'd get calls from men who were serving overseas, that they just wanted to talk to somebody who wasn't their family.
That was actually really touching.
Right. Like, they wanted to talk to, they were scared and worried, and they didn't want to talk to somebody else who was scared and worried about them. And so they just wanted someone to talk to them. And I thought that was amazing.
She did a great job humanizing that profession and those people. Okay. I think a lot of times, or people have a stereotype in their mind of why someone is behaving that way, or why somebody's is doing that work.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems very like, oh, I just want quick money. But there are certain people who really do things like that as a service. And when she's talking to the troops, and they essentially just want to be thinking about anything else in that moment. And a lot of times it wasn't even sexual.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty mm-hmm. commanding. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, there's so many themes in the book, whether we're talking about courage and depression and dating and career and family and relationships and psychics. But I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the psychic.
Oh, I love
because
that.
Because I'm going to read a quick passage. She's like traipsing around with her friend Crystal, and it's in like the TRL days in New York City. And she sort of talks about how they're in that weird phase where you're done being a kid, but you're not a full adult yet. So you're looking for activities to do because you kind of, like, you can't go to the bar, but you also can't go hang out at the arcade, right? So it spoke to, like, this really specific time in her life. But she goes to this psychic, and, you know, obviously lots of people think, you know, that's BS. I personally do as well.
I don't, for the record. I think that it's
again,
real.
the book made me question things. So here's the quote from the book. I'm telling you, you're special. You're going to be famous, girl, like Oprah. I do psychic readings for a living. I have a shop around the corner. I'd love to give you a reading. I do it for free. Gabrielle says she started to write the address and her number down on a piece of paper. This was exciting, but also kind of sketchy. Even then, I knew if something was free, I should be suspicious of it. She handed me her information and urged me to come in. I never did. It seemed crazy. At the time, I was at the worst stage of my eating disorder. I was depressed and pre-therapy. In other words, I was having a pretty bad time in life that year. At that point, I was contemplating not having a future at all. So hearing that something good was going to happen was important. Not that I really believe that psychic. So, she didn't go to the psychic that day, but then she returned to the psychic, and the psychic not only tells her that she's going to be a star, but one day she's going to be on a couch interviewed by Oprah.
Like, and then her stepmother, or like her other wife, because he had like multiple families, she also, yeah. wasn't she also, she said something to Gabourey like, You're gonna be famous or some. She also said some kind of like, kind of right. vaguely specific thing like you're gonna be famous.
In sort of the Outliers way, if you guys ever read Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, you know it's these people taking these wildly divergent paths to get to the same conclusion. So her mother has a script for the movie Precious in the house,
mm-hmm.
and it's been in the house for years. And she's helped her mom run the lines. And her mom decides that she's not going to be a part of the film, that it's not for her. So the script is still in the house. And then one day, over a period of time, Gabourey kind of doesn't know what to do with herself. So
her friend invites her to be in the play, right?
She's kind of enjoying the process of acting. And then suddenly, she sees an open casting call for the role of Precious. And she just, this is something about youth. She didn't know to be afraid. She just...
Right.
She just said, like, she decided I could either go to class or I could go and audition for this movie.
Right. Well, and so, like, I have a lot of feelings about this particular storyline, and I'm really happy you brought it up, because for me, there's kind of things that happen in life that, like, it's okay that they're mysteries, you know? Like, we don't need to explain why this happened or why the psychic stopped her or any of those things. It's okay that it's a mystery, but I love what you're saying about not knowing enough to be afraid.
Right.
I feel like there's so many times in life where we whip ourselves into such a frenzy about
sure.
things that are like dating or job interviews or auditions or whatever, and we almost kind of create our own fate by how we've talked to ourselves and gotten ourselves ready for something. And so, like, I think a lot about, I've been using this analogy a lot. Whether you are trying to cover it up or mm-hmm. suppress it, if there's desperation involved or terror or fear involved, it's going to be palpable to anybody who's paying attention. And yeah. so I think that those small, minute little things that we do, those behaviors, your body language, the words you use, they're really important because they're signals whether you like it or not. And I can think about so many times where I've been successful, and the reason I've been successful is because I've not been in my own head and I've stepped back and I've let my work speak for itself, or I've stepped back and I've said, okay, I'm not looking to get married or have it go on a date. And like, that's when Ron and I got together. Like, I decided, like, I don't care if I find a man, like, whatever, I'm going to go have fun and focus on myself. And that's the moment lightning strikes and it happens. And then the psychic thing, I feel really, I kind of feel like I identify with that part of Gabourey, where I've always kind of, I've had these people throughout my life in important moments tell me, like, yes, you are loud. Yes, you are, you talk too much. But it's a gift, and it's important, and you're going to do something important with it one day. And I think having somebody say that to you is an important thing. And I think that's, I try to be that voice for other people, is to give them validation that's external, because it's really hard when you're in your own head to be able to see the forest for the trees.
I just wanted to circle back to Gabourey going on the audition for the job.
Mm-hmm.
So, because her mother was a creative person, and the way that she sort of watched her parent maneuver, one of the things that I know I'm focusing on in the book that I'm writing is oftentimes the things that your parents say to you are just as important as the things they don't say to you.
Yes.
So she was watching how her mother sort of moved through the world, and I thought this quote was really interesting. Gabourey says, "I'd seen Mom's talent and drive, but more of her sacrifice and rejection. Dreams are dreams. Reality is something different. Reality is the electricity and cable being cut off for late payments and sleeping in the living room so that your children can each have a room of their own. No, thank you. I wasn't strong or talented enough to dream like Mom did." So for her, she was thinking, I'm going to find a job. And you know, I see my mom pursuing her dreams. That's what that looks like. She didn't even know enough to dream. And I think a lot of times when you're overweight or disfigured, or you have a disability, you kind of lose that light a bit. You really stop thinking certain things are an option for you.
Right.
And if you go to pursue those things, somebody's going to go, well, you're not the person that we think looks like someone who should be in this situation.
Right.
She's fantastic in every role that she's in, but you can't say that she's the quote unquote archetype of what people would be typically looking for.
Which is crazy.
and now, you know, and I think now she's turning it on its ear. So at one point after she visits the psychic, she has a quote where she says, "How many psychics does it take to convince a sad little girl that she can be much more than the world is telling her she is? None. She's got to be able to convince herself to show up for her life."
Yes.
And then you really start to see the thorough line in this book of that confident person we see on talk shows who is the life of a party. You know, she's the person who really is confident, and she had to build that muscle up all on her own.
Right. And then from there, you can say, like, okay, well, is there really anybody who truly knows you the way you know yourself? There's nobody. There's nobody. There is nobody who truly sees all of your parts, all of your sides, all of your insecurities, all of your victories. There's no one except you. And so when the chips are down, no one is going to be there for you. You have to decide to love yourself and not worry about what anybody else is doing, because you are the only person who sees all of it. Now, that makes it even harder, because there's no way to sanitize the version of yourself for yourself, you know? Like, But it's not going to be true, honest love and acceptance, which is what you need. And so, yeah, when the chips are down, you have to decide that you are good enough and you love yourself. And that's what she this what this book is about, essentially, right? And, yeah. like, and that doesn't mean there's not struggles, right? Because she even says, like, there are times she's insecure as hell, and some of that she discusses through the prism of her hair and her fashion choices.
Or the fact that, you know, she was a girl from New York City who ends up going to Sundance and Cannes Film Festival, and she's wearing, you know, dresses from Rainbow and Lane Bryant, standing next to women like Mariah Carey and Paula Patton.
Right.
And that, you know, and right. How does somebody stay confident in a situation like
On
that?
My best day, I wouldn't Gotta be confident be tough. In that freaking situation.
You know your ish is messed up, or that you haven't refined your style, when Mariah's like, I'll just pay for a stylist for, yeah. you for the rest of the run.
Right.
It's a lovely moment.
But that's so nice. That's the other thing. It was really nice to hear that these famous people who we kind of get, like, ideas about are real people with hearts and good hearts, and they're kind. And, like, sure. the Lee Daniels parts of the stories when he would talk to her, like, you got a sense of who Lee Daniels is as a person, and that he did really care about her, you
Aside
know.
Aside from the big-haired character that I think you get from news reports now, for sure.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, listen, sure. it's easy to become a caricature. I think especially if you're a person of color in the media industry, or some other non, like, mainstream white version of what, you know, the entertainment sure. industry accepts, it's very easy to be made into a caricature. But yeah. I did like how he, you know, how he kind of, like, encouraged her and said to her, you're going to be a star, like, Oprah's going to love you, mm-hmm. and, like, I really appreciated that stuff.
As we wind down here, one of the last things I wanted to talk to you about was, when Lee Daniels' influence comes into her life, and I think this happens a lot of time in business, and when you have a relationship with somebody who may be a little older than you, it can become parental, or mm-hmm. it can become in danger of becoming parental. So her family was destitute, and as she began acting, they became dependent on her. So they run into a rough spot, and then she kind of is, like, coming to Lee Daniels, like, save me. Mm-hmm. And I related to that so much because, as a minority, when you're a minority, you're sort of, depending on where you are in your life, someone like your parents may say to you, okay, you have to be the next big thing, and you have to be perfect, and you've got to do all these things. But it's never in the context of, I need you to be successful so that you can carry on in life. A lot of times it's, I need you to be successful so you can help pick up some of the slack around here.
Mm-hmm. And save us, or...
Right. So yeah. often, but what oftentimes happens is, you're trying to steady yourself, and as you're trying to steady yourself, you're being asked to then lift someone else. So the house isn't stable. And so there is a quote towards the end of the book, because she sort of wrestles with the fact that she is...
the head of household, right?
Head of household,
that
yeah.
That was great.
And she says, quote, they have jobs and careers, but I don't know what they would do if I stopped helping them. When we were all poor, we were on the Titanic together. But now that I am no longer poor, I'm on a lifeboat to safety, and my family is still sinking. I couldn't have imagined the responsibility of trying to pull them to safety with me. I couldn't have imagined how much it would hurt my back to try to pull them, or that it would last forever. There's a bravery in her talking about that, because I think a lot of times when you're in that position, it's, well, now that I've made it, I should feel lucky that I now get to, like, pull back and help people. But like I said before, when you're trying to steady yourself, it's hard to imagine how you have to go back and help other people.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
And this is just, like, as a white person, I'm curious. Do you think that culturally, because she is African-American, black, do you think that there's, do you think that situation manifests differently than it would if she were white?
Absolutely. I'll say, for instance, like, some of my friends here in D.C., they sometimes wonder, like, why I work as much as I do, and why I take on freelance jobs, and, hey, it's a 3-day holiday, why aren't you out, you know, going to the beach with us? And I'll say, like, oh, I decided to pick up this, like, extra work. And they're like, but you don't have to do that. And I'm like, what they don't understand is, I, much like Gabourey, grew up in a situation where sometimes my parents had to decide, is it the water or is it the electric this month? Like, what can we pay first? So for me, like, working is like, and I'm grateful to go chase after things because in my back of my mind, I'm always thinking, what if somebody needs something? Mm-hmm. What if something breaks? I essentially, like, nobody's told me the war is over.
Right. But, so do you think that that's cultural or poverty?
But I was just about to answer that.
So
To that point, I have a lot of friends who were Jewish and got money at their bar mitzvah that they have had in bank accounts since they were 15. I have friends who know they're getting endowments and inheritances from their family.
Blessed.
But those people have the benefit of generational wealth.
It's a different relationship to money.
Not only a different relationship to money, but an education about money.
Mm-hmm.
So people who don't have money oftentimes are so grateful when they get it. It's like, oh my God, now I can go buy XYZ, or you know what? Now we really need XYZ.
Right.
So it's always from it's never like, you know what? We should try to go and invest that and flip it. Mm-hmm. We should maybe, you know, we don't ever get ahead enough to be able to start to have that funny money conversation.
Interesting.
I'm just now in that spot. So
funny money.
Funny money. F you money. But in the book, I think there's a moment where Gabrielle talks about, like, she was just kind of spending money. And then all of a sudden, like, the well dried up. And I think that happens to you anytime in your life you're financially insecure. College.
Yeah.
You know, early 20s. So she's not the only person. I think it's more socioeconomic than it is race. But I also think that there isn't a level of wealth in minority communities where they even know how to react to having disposable money available.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Well, you guys should definitely, if you haven't started reading the book, This Is Just My Face, Try Not to Stare by Gabrielle Sidibe. We highly recommend it. It's a great, fun, and interesting poolside read for the rest of your summer. And don't forget that our next book, if you want to get ahead of the game, is Hunger by Roxane Gay. And we'll be talking about that towards the end of August, beginning of September. So go ahead and grab that. I've heard that it's a little dense and it's intense. So maybe get it and start working your way through it as you are able to do so. But thanks for joining us on this first voyage into the Swirl Book Club. We'll be right back with our
Here for It. Stay tuned.
We're back.
What are you here for, Ruby?
I am here for... I'm like... This is I'm a mom and I come to things way, way late. like I'm live tweeting movies and things that have been out for years because I find them on Netflix and they're great. So I'm here for this movie called Butter. Do you know of what I speak?
I do not.
Okay, it's on Netflix right now, so you can watch it for free. With your Netflix subscription. It's a movie about butter carving and the Iowa State Fair. Okay, if that hasn't sucked you in.
Wow.
It's not a documentary. It's an absurd dark comedy. And the casting in this movie is amazingly phenomenal. Jennifer Garner, Hugh Jackman, Ty Burrell before Modern Family, Olivia Wilde before she was a thing, and a bunch of other kind of like really interesting casting choices. And essentially it's a movie about this man who's like been the dynasty butter carver of the butter sculpture at the Iowa State Fair. I shit you not, for 15 years. And he's asked to step down and not compete so that other people can have a chance at, you know, being winning the butter carving competitions. And the movie goes on from there. Olivia Wilde plays a stripper with neck tattoos. It's amazing. And it's a great absurd and dark comedy. If you are into any kind of Christopher Guest kind of like those kinds of movies, okay. I highly recommend Butter. You can find it on Netflix and it is amazing. Jennifer Garner has an Iowa accent, which is, it's great. She's high strung. She's like Tracy Flick from Election, but in a butter carving.
I can never picture that from her when I see her in photos with Ben Affleck and the kids.
Oh my gosh, it's so good. It's like, this is her Tracy Flick. It's so fantastic. You should definitely watch Butter. I just watched it last week and I am here for it. Plus it's about butter. Come on.
It's about butter.
What are you here for, Cody?
Well, there was a really great video that was moving through social media a few days ago. And it was made in collaboration with London Pride, which recently took place in England.
Okay.
The BBC has a documentary called Against the Law that's going to come out sometime this month. And it's about when homosexuality was a crime. Like a literal, if they found you in bed with another man or a woman in bed with another woman, they could arrest you.
Oh.
So that was a thing during time. And right now, we see this a lot. I've been reading these articles about how the Jewish faith is in an impasse regarding, you know, intercultural marriages, right?
Uh-huh.
Because as people sort of move through the world, if you don't know your history, the quote is what? You're like a tree without roots?
Ah, yeah.
Okay. So in the gay community, we lost entire generation of men mm-hmm. in the 1980s and early 90s. I'm fortunate enough to have a family member who's in his late 50s who was able to give me history and context for why things like Stonewall happened or why people fought for HIV and AIDS awareness.
And who those people were and what they looked like and whitewashing it.
Absolutely. And the biggest issue is we have this big cavernous space in our community where it's really young guys or really old guys and nothing in the middle. So you think about all the culture and history and music and art, all these things that were lost because of that.
Yeah.
Because all those souls were lost. There's a video on social media that's circulating right now of a 13-year-old boy and a 78-year-old man having a discussion about the differences that 50 years have made on gay culture and acceptance.
Awesome.
So you get to ask the question of, what would you ask a gay person 65 years your elder? Especially someone who was growing up in a time where it was a crime to be homosexual.
Right.
So you'd never see people of these different ages sitting down and having the kind of conversation that Louis and Percy do. But they ask each other questions like, do you have a boyfriend? And the 13-year-old replies, yes, I do. I've had one for 2 years. And then the 78-year-old says, do your parents know? And he says, yes, they know. And then Louis gets to ask the 78-year-old Percy questions like, so how did you meet people back then?
Right.
but it's a completely genuine conversation. At different parts, they kind of cry together. And it's just, it's really beautiful and it's really touching and affecting. And I was able to reach out to the older person in my life and just thank him for being that, because in our community, I see that so many people are lacking that. And so many people don't know how to have relationships with older people if it's not financial or sexual.
Right.
Just a basic human, who are you level doesn't always happen. So I can't recommend it enough, and we'll be sharing it on our social media channels.
That's amazing. I love that so much. I think we have so much to learn from each other in so many ways. I love that so much. Right. Thank you, Cody.
Thank you. All right, guys, stay tuned because we'll be right back with this week's Q&A.
Hey. Here we are. It's time for some Q&A.
Hey.
I'm really excited to talk to you about this, Cody, because it hits on two very specific nerve endings that you and I have. All right, you ready?
Oh, boy.
Dear Let's Cody and Ruby, my husband and I have separate bank accounts with a joint account for bills. Since we make roughly the same amount of money, the bills are split 50-50 through the joint account, and the rest of our personal paychecks are for ourselves to spend as we wish. About 2 years ago, we happily decided together to have a baby. I couldn't conceive, and the doctors put me on a cocktail of hormones. The drugs are not covered by insurance, neither are the ovulation kits and pregnancy tests. This is an expense I have shouldered on my own. It has added up, and I find myself more and more in debt. My husband has seen how much I spend on all of these treatments, but has yet to offer to help with the financial burden. I've tried to be subtle. I once asked him to pick up a pregnancy test on the way home from work, but he has never done it since. But now, I just want to scream at him every time I come home with another prescription and he comes home with another man toy. It's bad enough that I already feel like it's my fault that we haven't conceived, but by not sharing in the financial aspects of this process, I feel even more alone. Am I off base to ask him to help pay for my treatments for a problem that is quote-unquote mine? Or is it just the overabundance of hormones that make me want to freak out on him? Signed, barefoot and not so pregnant.
Okay, I don't want to be sexist in saying that perhaps it might maybe a little bit of the hormones in the pills, the therapies she's undergoing. Uh-huh, uh-huh. But I will say this: have a good time going half on a baby with a person who doesn't seem very interested in having a baby.
Right. Oh my god!
It's a team effort.
Yeah,
it's a team effort on multiple levels, and certainly shouldering that cost is not your complete and total responsibility. But it maybe does say something about where your other half is on the subject.
Talk about putting for sure. Your money where your mouth is.
I'm all here for separating the finances and putting things in pots and, well, just overall fiscal responsibility. But I don't know that when you're trying to create a child that that's the time to be thrifty.
Right. Yeah. So I went through this. I went through this process of trying to get pregnant and going to the doctor and picking up these prescriptions that cost more than a mortgage. Like, it's intense. And
you know what? Like, anytime I sleep with women, I just give them $300, like, at the end. Not because they're prostitutes, but just like, so if you gotta go like take care of something, there you go.
I'm really wondering why we haven't slept together. I want $300.
My checkbook is on. I'm like Jerry Springer. I just like write hooker's checks.
$300 and the pleasure, my friend.
Exactly.
So...
I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just had to get that thought out.
No, that's amazing. But like, I cannot even imagine dealing with the emotional, physical, and psychological aspects of this, let alone going through the financial concerns alone. Right. Like, what? Like, no. And I have to say, yes, I totally think that your emotional, the calibration of your emotions going through the way that infertility treatment jacks up your hormones and fucks up your mind. And I'm saying that sincerely. Like, I'm crazy, and I was completely and totally insane during the times where I was injecting hormones into my body. And I think that I think that the consequences of doing that still manifest in my emotional and mental health and physical health, because I jacked my system up so much trying to get pregnant and being pregnant and trying to stay pregnant. So I definitely think your hormones are contributing to that, but I don't want you to think that that excuses your husband from any of the things that he's doing, or in some way makes you responsible for what's happening. I think that there is a come to Jesus conversation that has to happen. And if he is not interested in helping you financially conceive this baby, then I think you need to figure out if you even want to have a baby with him. Because then my next question is, if he's not helping you pay to get pregnant, who the fuck is going to pay for that baby? Because infertility ain't cheap, but let me tell you something. Babies?
Child rearing ain't cheap either.
Lord have mercy. Speak on it. But so...
And I don't mean to be... I don't mean to be sexist, but there is this trend with women who are... when they're looking to have children, where they... I don't want to say that the men aren't being consulted, but men are just kind of there.
Yeah.
And it's like, look, I want this baby, and you kind of serve your purpose. I got till 35.
Right.
It becomes a very self-centered thing. So she's pushing ahead on this, and she really hasn't considered that if he wants it or not, it's gonna come back to bite her.
And that's why I think you need to have a conversation. And the other thing, too, is, like, if you think that this situation is complicated now, I'm telling you straight up that when you have a child, it does not make it less complicated. In fact, it amplifies and exponentially how complicated it will be. So,
if you guys can't talk about money now, how the hell are you going to talk about circumcision or what daycare to go to,
right?
Or what religion you're going to raise the child in?
Totally.
It doesn't get easier from a decision-making standpoint. You're correct.
Exactly. So, Barefoot and Not So Pregnant, my heart goes completely out to you. That it sucks. It sucks so bad to go through what you're going through, to have it compounded by feeling like you're not being supported in a literal way and a figurative and emotional way. I cannot even imagine what that's like. But, girl, you got to get your shit together, and you got to make sure that he gets his shit together. Otherwise, you need to make a decision about whether you go this alone. You stop completely. Like, you got to figure out what your priorities are here, whether it's your marriage, having a baby. And that's not to say that maybe once you have a conversation with him, it will make he won't change. But the conversation is the important part.
Sure. And baby girl, if all else fails, apply for a joint credit card and just don't tell him about it.
Cody!
I'm just saying.
So bad.
Game recognizes game. Oh, you gonna pay one way or the other.
Manolos. What are those on there? Manolos. Progesterone.
Oh, boy.
Good great.
Oh, I'm gonna be alone for the rest of my life. People are terrifying.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, people are horrible. Sorry, I mean, like, it's true. We're terrible.
Jesus.
All right, well, there's your cue and hey. It's right about that time. It's time for Cody to take us to church. So, Cody, what do you got for us on that good word?
Well, thank you, Ruby. I have a new blog post up at CodySeton.com about goal setting that I'd love you all to go check out. It's called Go Go Goal Getter. And it's really about how I believe in accountability. And one thing I really believe is that if you really believe in something, or you believe in something that you're chasing, you should go to a friend and share with them your fantasies and your hopes, because doing so will make you accountable. And if you have a good friend, they'll also help to support you. So this week's quote comes from Irma Bombeck, who says, quote, "It takes a lot of courage to show your dreams to someone else." And you and I both know that it's true. It takes a level of vulnerability and also confidence to articulate how you feel about something or to chase something. So I really hope that anyone who's listening to us, if you have something that you've been thinking about doing for a while, big or small, speak it into existence and get to work on it.
And you know, Cody, that I am always here because I wanna know what your fantasy.
He never failed.
Rolled his eyes at me, you guys. Like, clear to the back of his head, he rolled his eyes.
It's 8:19 on a Wednesday. I'm really. The fact that I got this much talking done at this hour of the morning is remarkable.
It is. It is. Well, and you guys know that at 8:20, 8:19 in the morning on a Wednesday, and or like real late at night on a Friday night, the party doesn't end. It just
relocates.
Well, you can follow us on social at Swirl Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can follow Cody at Step to the Mic. On Twitter, I'm at Ruby Junkie, and mad love to our girl Justine, who helps us behind the scenes make the magic happen. In the meantime, be good to each other, and we'll catch you on the next episode of
The Swirl.